Danny, to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here, and it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work, and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
That was so fun.
Yeah, it sure was, especially the quiz. Thanks for preparing that for me.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Best when these things just turn into a conversation.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Yeah, you obviously got the book.
Good on you for fighting the good fight, too.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
I love your enthusiasm. I just think it's a brilliant thing you're doing, a podcast about, you know, books, and you do a lot of great interviews, so I'm really honoured to be part of it.
I so enjoy listening to the podcast. I love it.
You're listening to Words and Nerds Podcast with Danny V.
Sarah Miles' latest novel, The Wolf Hour, published by Allen & Unwin, is a confronting and beautifully written piece of literature set in Uganda and explores the political and social issues within South Africa, as well as the significance of empathy and humanity. The Wolf Hour centres around Tessa, who was in Uganda doing postdoctoral research on child soldiers when her family learned she has gone missing, abducted by rebels. Tessa is naive, says her brother Stephen, an importer with dubious connections, but it is her naivety that draws her into danger and ultimately a more confrontational understanding not only of herself but the world in which she has ventured.
Welcome, Sarah. Thank you so much for your time. I'm really excited to talk about The Wolf Hour today, an intriguing novel.
Thanks, Danny. It's an absolute pleasure to be talking with you.
The Wolf Hour is an intense novel. It's set in Uganda amongst the LRA, the Lord's Resistance Army, and leader Joseph Kony. It's a confronting book, and this is not said as a criticism, but why was it important for you to tell this particular story?
Well, I like that you say that it's a confronting book, because in some ways I think the impetus to write for me has always been that there are problems in this world that we can't fix. And part of the wonderful thing of storytelling and of literature is to explore those. So I think what started this story off was sort of like a little bit of a micro story, really, was that I was out and I met a couple and they were talking to me about their daughter who, you know, is 30-year-old, was going to East Africa to do research into war-affected children. And they were, look, you know, they were just so mixed and ambivalent in many ways. There's a familial pride mixed with anxiety and concern. And that was about 10 years ago that happened. And I came away and the character was just there. The family sort of started to form. And also I've had this incredible interest in Africa and politics and so forth. So that was the seed that sort of got the whole thing rolling.
And you've visited Africa a number of times, haven't you?
Yes, I have. So I've been several times to South Africa, where part of the book is set, and also specifically, once I was sort of several drafts into the novel, I really wanted to go to the actual area where, you know, the book is set. I didn't get to all aspects of it because there's still some areas of high security, particularly in Congo, but I did go to the border, and that was fantastic. But the best thing that came out of that was actually meeting people and hearing firsthand stories and just the smell of – it's such a different landscape because it's equatorial, but it's also very high. It's quite mountainous, and so just the smell of the earth, it's just this hot earth smell, and the wildlife and the feel of it was just, you know, I just fell in love with the place. And there's, you know, just an insatiable hunger, I think, once you travel, to want to travel more. So that's very much in me.
I think you captured the setting very well, because when you talk about, you know, the richness of the smell and the landscape, you know, you were there in the novel. You know, I haven't been to Africa myself, but I felt it because you made the imagery so, you know, realistic, so important. And look, going back to being confronted, I think it's important that we are confronted, because we can look at what's in our media and we never know how controlled that is. But looking at it from a different perspective, from someone who has, you know, heard from people's stories and been there, I think it's a part of people gaining empathy and then really understanding or trying to understand all the complexities around the issues going on.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it is that thing that there's no one story. There's so many different stories. And so even, you know, in me trying to tell this story, of which there are, you know, a combination of narrative threads, it's so small in terms of the number of stories that are out there. And, you know, when I was speaking to people, and also the research that I did, you know, I read hundreds of testimonials from child soldiers and, you know, the kinds of PhDs that Tessa was doing. And that those stories were just like fragments of a much bigger picture. And I think what I then was trying to do was to somehow, you know, create a sort of a little microcosm of the bigger picture, but to give it veracity and detail.
And I think we very much have the advantage of reading from the safety of our own homes. I spoke to Dr. Michael Muhammad Ahmed a while ago, who wrote The Lebs, and that's also a very confronting book, very different context. Mm-hmm. But, yes. You know, he made a good point by saying, well, we have the advantage of hearing about these experiences, but we're in the safety of our own homes, you know. So if you're a bit confronted, you know, well, so what?
Yes, certainly.
Now, from the very first page, it's quite confronting, you know, the violence in Uganda. And the book says, there was none of this glossy exoticism of tourist guides. This was village business. You know, how important do you think it is to really capture the reality of Uganda and its people for us to gain a better understanding and empathy?
I think you really need to have the detail, as I sort of said before, just for that sense of truth and veracity. Like anything, you know, if you're hearing a story about your own city and there's some, you know, specific detail in it, that's the thing that sort of is connecting. But having said that, and even though, you know, we're talking about sort of confronting things, we still, you know, we have a lot of unrest and violence in our own culture. You know, I've got a past of working as a nurse, and you know what you sort of can see that presents in casualty and those sorts of things, that is there too in our culture. So there's, I think, all writing is about, you know, humanity and the difficulties and the triumphs and things that we experience. So there's the juxtaposition of it being in a different culture, but there's also the similarities too.
And we see that with the family, don't we, with Stephen and Tess and the parents?
Yes. Yeah, we do.
It's very present. Now, throughout the novel, just going back to the conflict, there's conflict between the people in Uganda and the visiting Westerners, you know, their medicine, their ideals, their religions, their beliefs. Was this your experience in your time and through your research there?
I think, yes, yeah. So there's an overlap. I think that, you know, there's a lot of criticism even of NGOs and people like my character Tessa who go there with sort of good intentions but can sometimes be a bit wrong-footed. And then on the other hand, there's bigger sort of issues of a kind of almost a neo-colonialism of the West's presence in places like Africa, you know. And I think my character, Stephen, to some extent represents some of those complexities just in terms of exploitation and so on. So that was very much in my mind when I was writing the book too, and going further into discussions with people and research into that, and just actually being on the ground and sort of seeing Western infrastructure and whether it's good for the country or whether it's just actually, you know, there for mining purposes. I mean, all those factors sort of were sort of painting this bigger canvas for me all the time.
Yeah, and would you agree that the issues are not as cut and dry as we led to believe? Because we hear in your book the perspectives of the LRA and Kony, and they're very complex in that they believe they are doing God's work. And Dominic states, we can't negotiate because he believes he is fighting the whole world, cast in the role of a guerrilla rebel and labelled a terrorist, and that is what he's become. So it's like this transformation of what his intentions initially were.
Exactly. And any insurgent group, they believe in what they're doing. They're fighting the good fight. And there is truth on both sides and there is complexity on both sides. And part of the presence of the LRA there was to show that they do have their own issues and they do feel that they've been denied rights and privileges at the expense of, you know, other people. So it's a civil war in that there is a rift between different groups.
It's so intriguing, though, that humans can justify just about anything, can't they? Even when they justify taking children away from their families, like, oh, we're doing God's work. And it's interesting that you can just about justify anything to yourself.
You can. This is true. There's so much sort of self-delusion in what we do. And there's also myth-making, and that is part of the story too, that, you know, we in the West sort of see things, you know, through the lens of the media, and that's not the whole picture. So that's also a type of delusion in presenting the story, that how do these sorts of things get to this level?
That's what I loved about the book so much. You know, just it gave you another level of understanding, and I really like getting that from my fiction.
That's great to hear.
Now, the book deals with trauma, particularly childhood trauma, as we just touched on then. And in the book, these children had been indoctrinated and damaged, yet some were less likely to develop post-traumatic stress than others. And I found this really intriguing. Can you tell us more about the impact of violence and indoctrination of children and, you know, the consequences of that for him and how that differs for some people? I found that really interesting.
Yeah, well, I guess it's along the level of survival and what is it that makes us survival and what is it, how does memory function and why is it that some people will remember and their memories be, you know, distorted and traumatized more significantly than others. This was really what Tessa was sort of going to, you know, try and look at more closely. And there are no real answers given in the novel other than the fact that people experience life differently, people survive in different ways, some better than others. What we see in the character of Francis, who's, you know, only 13, is that he's very clever, and because he's very clever, he's very good at surviving, but he is traumatised, and that trauma is then internalized and incorporated into him and how he functions and lives.
And one of the saddest parts of the story for me was Francis's story, and obviously we're not going to spoil it for everyone, but it really sort of resonated with me in a way that I felt so much empathy for him. And very simple conversation made me feel just how trapped they are. He says, "Do you have war in your country?" And Tess shook her head. "How much does an aeroplane cost?" "About $1,000 US. Then I will not be going there." And it's just so simple but so devastating that this is his life and there's no way out of it.
Yeah, that's very true. I think when I'm thinking about my characters and developing them, I don't really regard them as fictional characters. I think of them as real people I might know. So, you know, there is that awkwardness, you know, they're difficult people, they're confessing to each other or they're withholding information from each other. And that was part of that relationship between Tess and Francis. They're coming from different worlds and it's their coming to understand each other as real people.
And it was interesting as well, we talk about Francis and we talk about memory and trauma. And, you know, in the book it says that it can be triggered because it just lays under the surface of the skin. But then it says, if the memory of something terrible worked as a survival tool, if it reminded you how not to let this happen again, it had a purpose. Isn't that interesting how some people use memory in a way that benefits them and some people, you know, I'm sure not deliberately or intentionally, trauma and that memory traumatizes them. Isn't that interesting, the two different paths you can take?
I find it so fascinating, almost in that sometimes it's harder for us to remember our good memories than our bad memories. Mm. You know, if you talk to people, they will be able to tell you, you know, what they were wearing on a day when such and such happened, that it was, you know, it was a terrible event. And but if you say, well, you know, I can often remember my mother looking at a photograph of herself at a birthday party that she was at and really loving it and saying, I never wore that dress. I would never have bought a dress like that. So there's a sort of like a complete, you know, forgetting of something that was, you know, this celebrated memory and this celebrated day. And yet we can sometimes have such acute reoccurring memories of something that was awful. And yet maybe there's something in that. Or so the research suggests, that it reminds us that you don't go to that bad place again. And I found that really interesting as a universal archetypal thing, and then heightened in a situation where you've got something as life-threatening as, you know, being a soldier in a war.
And it is absolutely intriguing because I read some other research as well about memory that says each time you draw upon a memory, it's influenced by your emotions, your feelings, your context at the time. So if you remember a part of your childhood 10 times, by the time you get to the 11th time, it's been shaped by all those other times you've thought of it, and that's contributed to that memory. How wild is that?
That is so wild. And also that you can change memories to some extent by actually reconfiguring them. You can go down a different pathway and have your own fictionalized memory, which we all know that we do when we listen to people telling different perspectives, or sometimes when you tell a story that you've told before and suddenly another detail will come to you, or you've dropped a part out of it. So memories are very
malleable.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, it's interesting that the conflict, as we touched on before, isn't just in Uganda, and Tess attempts to find peace or help people in Uganda find some sort of peace, and yet she can't even find it in her family. And it made me think, does that mean that is conflict just inevitable because we're human? Obviously, it's a different type of conflict, but conflict all the same.
Oh, yes, that's an excellent point. When the story was sort of forming, I was thinking of these two things. And, you know, civil war on a macro level, which is explored with the Lord's Resistance Army, and then on a micro level within a family with, you know, there's a civil war actually happening in the family. And it is like a microcosm of the world, and how divergent we can be from our siblings, or how, you know, a parent can disown a child or be disappointed by a child, and that can really sort of just, you know, cause, you know, complete rift.
And it's unfixable in a way that the conflict in Uganda is unfixable. You know, it's not this easy fix of we'll just sit down at the dinner table and have a family talk. They're really complex issues, especially when we get to the story about Stephen.
Yes, it is. It's very adult. It's very non-Disneyland, isn't it? I think it's very, this is the way the world works. And yet in that, you know, and it's not to say that there's not without hope, and there's not without the other intense feelings of incredible love. You know, there's this ambivalence of, you know, if you really invested in somebody and they do something in your eyes wrong, what's your moral responsibility, and how far do you go for your children, and things like that. So I was really, you know, concerned with at looking at those intenser issues.
Yeah, and the relationships between the parents and their children. As a parent myself, it was terrifying and fascinating that we become so powerless as they become adults. You know, as when they're our children, we're kind of in control, and then we just have to let them go, and we see them doing something terrible or something that's going to cause them harm, and we can't do anything about it.
Yet you still feel responsible, don't you? And you're never really going to be able to sever that. But then what do you do if you feel it's a problem that's too difficult for you?
Yeah, and the parents say, you know, you can't live their lives for them, which is so true, but it's terrifying, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's also one of the great things about storytelling. You know, if you think of, say, the Greek tragedies, and how they are sort of a map, really, for how far a situation can go. And with fiction, it is that sort of platform where I think we can look at a story and we can look at a real dilemma and think, well, you know, characters are so fascinating because one character will do something in a certain situation, whereas another character might do something. So I, as a parent, if my child does something, might do A, somebody else might do B. And in writing the fiction, I felt that was really interesting. And so it was such a fantastic exercise to be able to follow down the different paths. And when I say about the Greek tragedy, you know, when you look at that, that's that huge canvas of, you know, where everybody ends up, you know, in a terrible position at the end. But the big lessons are learnt nonetheless.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Oedipus Rex, my favourite.
Yes, and that's a very good example.
I don't know what resonated with me, because I learnt that way back when I was in year 12 in drama, and I just loved it so much. And I'm thinking now, what on earth resonated with a 17-year-old girl about Oedipus Rex? But to this day, it's just a story that I love telling, and I love telling
people. It's a great story, and it's a classic family drama and a family tragedy, and also a sort of a family curse. If you do something, there will be consequences. That you know, a person is what happens to them and what they do to others. So, yeah, I agree with you. I find it very fascinating.
I think what fascinated me about Oedipus Rex was the fact that despite you trying to, you know, not make choices that were good, it can still come undone. You know, some things are just going to happen no matter what you do. And I find that really interesting, how much control you have and how much control the world has.
Yes, it's that sort of thing of, you know, is your character fate? To the extent where, you know, a certain person will do a certain thing in a certain situation. So I find that, you know, so it is our character. Our character is sort of our fate too.
Yeah, which brings us back to Stephen. Maybe it wouldn't have mattered what the parents had have done when he was a child. Maybe he was just going to end up being that person.
Well, that's right. Is he, you know, I mean, he certainly has elements of a sort of, you know, entitled. He gets all the best lines in the book, certainly, Stephen, and he has a good time. But he is, to some extent, amoral. And is that something that's embedded in his DNA or is that his environment? And those are sort of issues that I think, you know, thread through the story as we go along. There's different elements there at play.
And Stephen makes comparisons to the wildness and freedom of Africa to the nanny state in Australia. And I found that a really interesting comparison, because then Francis, you know, previously says, oh, is there war in your country? So it's almost like, does that kind of freedom and wildness then come with war and conflict? And does a, you know, nanny state, as he so, you know, describes Australia, is that the only way you cannot have conflict? Like, it just got me thinking about that. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it from that point of view. So that's a great angle. Certainly, Stephen and Francis have something in common. There is a connection there, and on whatever level, that's another path as well.
I think Stephen could have his own book and a sequel, to be honest.
You're not the first person to say
really? That. I just found, you know, that complex character. I think obviously we've only touched the surface of that character and his actions and the choices that he makes. And it would be very interesting to see psychologically where that comes from. You know, it's got to be more than money. It's got to be more than just pushing boundaries.
Yes, yes.
Interesting. Yes. I don't know that you have the answers. I just, you know, thought it was interesting. It's funny when a kind of a secondary character, I guess he's not a secondary character, he has his own perspective, but I think ultimately it, you know, begins as Tess's story, but I feel like Stephen just intrigued me so much.
Not whether so much that they're likeable or they're good, it's whether they're alive. Mm. And Tess is much more cerebral, she's much more sort of concentrated, internal character, which is a harder character essentially to write than someone like Stephen, who is by very nature his action and his extrovert and his dialogue. So we get, you know, it's quite a contrast between them.
It's enjoyable to dislike Stephen, I found. I was always trying to get in his head.
Why are you
doing this?
I think it's also knowable elements too of people's behaviour, of that sort of, you know, his ability to tease, you know, his sister in a sense, to sort of bait her in some ways is a very sort of interesting
and real. You see it with siblings all the time.
You do.
Now, with this novel having elements of stories and fragments and people that you've met and experienced, and then having that fictionalized family, but then that young girl who you met who was going to Africa, How did you then put this all together, and what was the writing process to get all this together in a coherent story?
Well, it took a long time, as I think, you know, most books do. And for me, you know, there are different processes at different stages in the writing. So, you know, whether it's, you know, your habit, whether you're working intensely, you like to work in the morning or you like to work in the afternoon. But I think the book begins, you know, I'm very open and you're very porous to ideas. And so then you just sort of, I find that you just sort of want to write and you get all that into a first draft. But then, well, you have to throw lots away. And I think that's when I start to try and think about, you know, a really strong narrative thread, because whatever else, the characters, they need momentum. So it's sort of moving along with that. So I don't know any shortcuts, I'm afraid. So that, I guess that's the thing. It's sort of, you know, it's multiple drafts, it's rearranging of facts in order to make them more significant. And it's just a sort of a constant correction of errors until there's a right sound to it. So I think that's largely the way I sort of go into it. And then, you know, if at any point you're sort of stuck, it's good to go for a long walk or read. I love to read. So that's another way to sort of is integral to the process.
Which is an excellent segue for my very next question, because I want to ask authors what they read, because I think it's really important for us to be, you know, writing and reading simultaneously. So what either have you read this year that has been really significant or that you've loved, or what are you reading now?
I'm currently reading The Milkman at the moment, which I'm really enjoying for the voice. I just sort of find like I'm in a pub somewhere in Northern Ireland, and that's an interesting backdrop too, because I have a Irish heritage, and so the Civil War, the Troubles, which was really a very brutal civil war, was very much a part of my upbringings. But I'm a huge reader. I'm sort of in a reading group. We read classics and things, and I reread. I can't, it's very hard to, when you're asked to sort of, you know, pick out the ones. Yeah. But I do. I read a lot for this book too, a lot of African writers, which was been really great. A terrific friend of mine, Doreen Bangana, who's written a book called Tropical Fist, which is a collection of short stories, was integral in, you know, in sort of having a sort of an idea of Entebbe, which I don't really use that much in the novel. I guess all these sort of things are just little bits and pieces that you pick up. Reading's such a huge part of life. In fact, I was talking to this lovely guy who's my oldest fan, I think. He's 97 recently. Wow. And he said the best part of his day is when he has a cup of tea in bed and he reads for the first hour of the day. And I just thought that was just so fantastic. I really love that idea, that that's how you begin your day rather than, you know, looking at your phone or anything like that. Shakespeare's another one I love because, you know, he's that mixed genre of there's the fool and there's the king and there's the story, there's the, you know, there's often the violence on the stage, and then, you know, then there's his incredible fascination with the human condition. So those sorts of things I come back to time and time again. And
there's still those books that you keep coming back to and you think, I'm different because I've read that?
Yes. Yeah, and that's crucial, isn't it? I love that thing. The books that change, you know, I can remember reading Patrick Wyatt, who's not an easy read, and But years ago, and being really, really changed by the way he saw the world, and putting, I think it was Voss and then Tree of Man. So they're sort of, you know, they're both, you know, quite complex texts. And I sort of read them back to back when I was quite young, and just feeling so different when I put those books down, you know, that something had happened in the way that something neurological had happened.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I read a lot of contemporary, obviously, because I talk to authors of contemporary, but if we're going back into the classic, I think the two novels that really sort of affected me in that way would be Love in the Time of Cholera and The Picture of Dorian Gray.
Yes.
Oh, I just love those two. I use the picture of Dorian Gray. I think it can relate to any context at any time.
It's brilliant, isn't it? And it's such a visual book too.
Yes.
You know, it's
yes.
got, you know, the story is brilliant in it, the language is brilliant in it, but just you see that painting change. Yeah. You know, you see the sort of, you know, in fact, Dorian Gray in some respects, you know, is a sort of a bit of a template for characters like Stephen. You can sort of see, you know, their outward appearance, which is really, and then their inward appearance, what is going on. You
and
know?
Then you look at social media today and how relevant is Dorian Gray for social media and corruption and, you know, appearances versus what's really going on your, you know, Facebook post compared to what's really going on. I just find it fascinating and think that it's so relevant. And social media obviously wasn't back when Wilde was writing that.
no, and that's so true. My daughter's got a line about social media, and I love it. She says, you know, social media, it's looking at social media, it's like watching somebody else's showreel and comparing it with your behind the scenes. And I think that that's how a lot of contemporary society seems to be running at the moment. You know, we have this sort of picture perfect of people's images on their social media, but there's so much more behind the scenes that you don't see. And often it's a misreading of things, which takes us back to really reading a novel where there's so much more depth in it and you can go to many more places. And yet social media is such a connecting and a powerful tool and obviously here for the long term.
And it's such a new thing for us that, you know, we don't know the impact of it. We don't know how to use it properly yet, I don't think. We're making mistakes on it, and I worry about this.
I think it is, it's history happening, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, people who lived through the Industrial Revolution, the Agrarian Revolution, you know, we've had this technological revolution, and now we're at it's now in its kind of, it's in its young adulthood, and we've got social media that's come of it. So it's, who knows where it'll go. It's fascinating, but it's fraught at times.
Absolutely.
I
and so what's next for you? I feel like there's not going to be a Stephen sequel.
I've got two sort of projects. So it's just which one sort of takes precedence over the other. The first is a work that I had been working on that I still am very interested and invested in the characters in, and the other one is completely new and different, and it's more sort of my landscape really for that is the ocean, which is a great love of mine, but I'm not sure that's very much in its infancy, so I'm just sort of really playing with ideas at the moment.
Oh, sounds very interesting, and I look forward to some new work. I really enjoyed The Wolf Hour, and I took my time with it, and it made me go onto the internet and do some more research about things that I, you know, needed to know more about, and it was just such an enjoyable read on both levels in terms of learning about different things in this context and, you know, the family drama of it, and as we said before, kind of like a bit of a thriller as well. So there were so many elements to it that I really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for The Wolf Hour. What I thought was such an insightful and intelligent read, and I hope that this conversation reflects that.
Thanks, Danny. You're such an open reader, and it's excellent to talk with you. Thanks for your thoughtfulness. It's great.